Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 9th of February. One of the questions facing Egypt is what will happen when the country's President Mubarak leaves office? Our guest this first hour wrote that in a recent book, and I'm sure that question was on his mind as he was in Cairo recently as protests gathered strength around the country. Our guest this hour is from Marquette University, and he's joining us in our downtown Milwaukee studio. He is Professor Philip Naylor, Professor of History at Marquette, co-editor of State and Society in Algeria, author of France in Algeria, A History of Decolonization and Transformation, The Historical Dictionary of Algeria, and North Africa, A History of Antiquity, A History from Antiquity to the Present. He has contributed to the Encyclopedia of the Modern Middle East, the Biographical Encyclopedia of the Modern Middle East, has served as a teacher of the history of the modern Middle East and the history of North Africa, two separate courses rather than tangentially tying North Africa to a Middle East course. He also teaches history of the Byzantine Empire and has won awards for teaching excellence. He was also in Israel on this recent trip, and we may add that this was very recent. He was in Cairo at the end of January, as I said, as the protests were gathering steam, and was also in Israel, and we'll be sure and ask him about Israel's response and perhaps their concern about what's going on in Egypt. So there is much to discuss this hour. He's kept up on the latest news every day since he's been home, which hasn't been all that long. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for him, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Philip Naylor, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
So you didn't expect, I'm sure, to find yourself on the downtown streets of Cairo with these massive protests when you left Milwaukee.
Well, I did, actually.
Oh, you did?
I did, in that I knew that there was something was happening on the 25th, about a week before. I caught something in the news saying that a protest day of anger was in preparation, and that was going over the social network. So I figured that there could be something. I didn't chalk it up at all because I didn't want to worry people, but when we were in Morocco, and I traveled with Terrence Miller, who was our director of international education at Marquette, we both kind of anticipated that there might be some issues in Egypt.
Mm-hmm. And when you got there and you were in Tahrir Square, mm-hmm. and there were lots of people there, lots and lots of people there, who were they? I've wondered, who are the people who have been gathering?
Well, when we arrived. Let me put this in chronological context. The protest began on the 25th, mm-hmm. and we arrived in the evening of the 26th. And as we drove, and you've seen these highways that go across bridges and everything in Cairo and some of the news networks, we saw certainly security police, them in formation, for that matter. However, I did not see any protests at that time. The following day, which would be the 27th of January, I went into Tahrir, and again, it was like the lull before the storm, before anything else. There were certainly security police out. I tried to do some photography, and I did do some photography, but I did it with some apprehension because it was a tense, situation. But again, I was not there when the rubber bullets began, flying, and when people were riding horses and camels and things like this. I wasn't there for that, but I was there for kind of the buildup of this. And that evening on the 27th, I met a British friend of mine who lives in Cairo. He's a political scientist, and we just talked over the situation. He was convinced that these changes are now are very important changes, and that on Friday, after the day of prayer, there would be serious protests, and he was, of course, correct.
Mm-hmm. When did you start asking the question, what will happen to Egypt when Mubarak leaves office?
Well, I've been asking that question for a long, long time. What you have across North Africa, which and the whole region interests me, is a kind of a gerontocracy. You have all these older rulers, and you don't have constitutional processes necessarily for a transition. And as you know, with regard to Egypt, there wasn't even a vice president. And so you had the grooming of Gamal, the son of Hosni Mubarak, and that, of course, was quite controversial. But in Algeria, we have Abdelaziz Bouteflika, who has not been well. He's way into his 70s now. And as we, of course, we had Ben Ali, but he's gone. And in Libya, of course, we have Gaddafi, who is getting older, and he has two sons who seem to be vying for power. That's a very interesting situation. And of course, we had the situation in Mubarak. What makes Egypt so important is its strategic significance with the Suez Canal, and of course, with over 80 million people living there. It's the largest Arab state, and so that was always a worry.
Right. And the people that you spoke with and the professors you spoke with talked about the root of the great dissatisfaction being what? Unemployment, being the way they were treated, possible torture of citizens. What was it?
Well, one professor told me that basically it was just time for Mubarak to leave, in part because he's been there so long. But what I kept on hearing from people, particularly younger people, and we did have a chance to talk with the Egyptian college students, is there great dissatisfaction with the educational system. And of course, what we're dealing with too is an economy which cannot satisfy the job hunger here of the youth. We have a society that is quite well educated, and you have youth who are just exasperated, frustrated by the fact that they cannot exercise and cannot use their education, and it's a real tragic situation. As you know, Marquette's a global university, and what we were also trying to do is to find some students who might be interested in Marquette, and we talked with students, and they you can almost sense a desperation in trying to leave Egypt in order to continue with their education, and that was very moving.
Hmm. So you found a number of students who would like to come to Marquette.
Oh, sure. Sure, absolutely,
right.
Yeah.
What do people do, the majority of people, we were talking about this watching television last week, to make a living in Egypt?
I mean, it's amazing. When you go through Cairo, these little streets, people are selling almost anything. And this is, again, all the way across North Africa. I remember being in the old city of Fez, and someone just selling toothbrushes.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it was just fascinating. People just selling soft drinks, just to make a living. And of course, when we go into the Tunisian situation, I mean, we saw how desperate people are with regard to just trying to stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm used to studying this area. I've been over before, but you're still shocked by the fact that, people, have to survive this way. And there are a lot of people in Cairo, a city of 7 million, 17 million with the metropolitan area, who are just trying to make ends meet. And, they just don't have the time to, let's say, get involved with a political program or even protest, because they have to try to feed a family, feed themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But having said all that, there's a certain vitality to Cairo that is really quite unforgettable. Mm-hmm. It's a great, great city, and the people are great.
Mm-hmm. And are there, among all the people who have been protesting, is there a plan for a transfer of power? Is there a group that has more organization than another group that's more likely to move in?
I don't see any type of program right now,
really?
In part because of the fact that the opposition has been hammered, to quote my British friend, for so long. And of course, the accelerated protests, the escalating protests, caught people by surprise too. And even with Omar Suleiman's comments yesterday and the idea of setting up a constitutional committee, and people want something palpable, something tangible that they can really link onto and say, hey, reform is actually going to happen. Because essentially, the people who are involved here in this reform process right now are people who are part of the system, part of an authoritarian system, and they just don't have the confidence of people in the street, and particularly young people.
And
when we talk about the Muslim Brothers, Muslim brothers are certainly fractured too in some respects. And when you watch cable TV in particular, I mean they're presented as a monolithic group, and they have issues.
And are they, you were also in Israel, is there a concern, there is, I know, among some people, because we hear from them and will in the United States about the Muslim Brotherhood.
Right.
Who are they? Are they very radical? Does Israel have concern about their security? Should they take power? Will they take power? Fill us in.
Well, right now, I've seen, and this is and this has been corroborated by other people, that maybe they could control 20 to 40% of a parliament. But having said that, within the brothers themselves, the brotherhood themselves, or in Arabic, the Ikhwan, you have groups there that are more liberal than others. I don't see a general consensus with regard to, let's say, scrapping the 1979 treaty at all, because I think all Egyptians understand that yes, there are certainly issues with regard to the Palestinians and how the Palestinians are treated. However, when it comes to the idea of peace, I mean, peace has benefited Egypt as well as Israel, and I think that's understood. There might be more pressure put on Israel, and I think there is pressure on Israel right now with regard to maybe, reworking or reconfiguring the Palestinian relationship again. There was an article by Friedman in the New York Times, I think about a week ago, saying that this might be the time to perhaps ratchet up negotiations and come to some kind of a conclusion or some kind of a resolution or some type of an important step toward a resolution, given the instability in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, a lot's going on. The Israelis are on the edge of their seats, though. I mean, the ones that I've talked to, and I talked to people, again, ranging kind of across the social strata, but in particular with intellectuals and people involved with, political affairs.
It's hard to imagine, Professor Naylor, that these, from what we see and read, the economy is pretty much at a standstill.
Yeah,
people are maybe trying to do a little bit of work, but the banks aren't dealing with anything and that nothing is going on. How long can people gather day after day in these huge numbers and protest?
Well, this is a great question, and Kathleen, in that the economy has, which I haven't even talked about yet, is really the key, I think, to the whole situation. The stock market, when I was there on the 27th, dropped 10%. That's about $10 billion, and then they, then they shut it up. They closed the doors. It's supposed to open again on Sunday, I believe, and that's going to be kind of a litmus test. If that market falls again, and if the economy and the Egyptian pound continue to tank, then I think you're going to see some really important changes within the government itself. Then I think that Mubarak might have to step aside.
Mm-hmm. And all right, let's go. Now we're back to that original question.
Right.
If he steps aside, then what would happen? Who's going to be in charge?
Well, it's going to be the military. We'll have to try to come to some type of a consensual candidate here. People that talk about Mohamed el-Baradei and as being somebody, but he's not a very popular person necessarily within the opposition parties, in part because he's been away so long.
Mm-hmm.
But when he has spoken, I think he has addressed something which others have not, and that is this existential question of how this authoritarian government has really affected the identity of Egyptians, the personality of Egyptians. People are saying, the step to democracy is going to be very hard for the Egyptians. I believe, like the Tunisians, that they certainly have the intellectual capital for this, and that this can happen. Now, can it happen really soon? That is another issue, and in part, it's a question of developing some kind of a process which is inclusive. It's a question of just trying to gain trust among the different parties. They've been at each other too. I mean, it's a really difficult situation to the point that there's been very little option on the part of the United States but to deal with these guys who still have power, and that would be like Umar Suleiman and and the president, Mubarak.
Mm-hmm. Go back. When you said earlier that the opposition has been hammered, how have they been hammered?
Well, you've had these parties, you've had leaders who have been imprisoned, you've had demonstrations where you've had these, you know, these thugs who have come out and they've you know, beat up on people over the years. Certainly, the brothers have been outlawed. They were allowed to run as independents in 2005, and they gained about 88 seats in the parliament, which seemed to indicate, you know, that they certainly still had some influence. But after that, again, you know, you had once again the government coming down on them, and it's been a really a sad situation in that the opposition has not been allowed to exist, or when it has been allowed to exist, it's been co-opted incredibly, you know. It's been very, very difficult to mount an opposition in Egypt, and it's really unfortunate, again, because some very vital, productive, creative people.
Who made the decision to beat up and detain all these journalists?
Well, it's interesting, again, because, you know, when you look at the Tunisian situation, Ben Ali, you know, blamed Al Jazeera for a lot of his problems. And this is not unusual to go after the media and then to try to stimulate nationalism. These are foreigners. You have foreign elements here trying to, you know, hurt Egypt or hurt Tunisia. I think that decision was made by the government because of the continuing bad press it was getting. When I was there, they did cut off internet service. They did cut off the social network as much as possible. So they understood, I think, you know, that this was a danger. This was perilous to their own positions.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of Al Jazeera, is that the best coverage to get an understanding of exactly what's going on, and we can't see it
you
very
know,
well here?
I think you do get good coverage with Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya. I've been going through the blogosphere. I'm going all over the place,
I imagine.
But I can, just trying to get some information, and it is difficult. But again, just being there and then tangibly, you know, feeling, you know, that something was going on, that, you know, not all Egyptians, certainly, I think, you know, understood, you know, the significance of all of this, in part because it was so unusual. I had one Egyptian tell me that he thought that it was overblown, at least the first protest. But of course, I haven't talked to him, you know, since I left, in part because I couldn't contact him. But the point is that it's all been very surprising. And certainly, you know, journalism and the media has been caught by surprise too. Mm-hmm. So they've had to scramble. They've had to do their research and to find people.
Mm-hmm. And when you, because you're a student of this region and have been for some time, when you think about what may happen, do you believe that it will be better for Egypt, or do you worry that...
Well,
it will be worse or about the same?
I've been thinking about this, for a while. And, you know, I really fear that there's going to be some violence again.
Really?
Yeah, I really do. I think that's going to happen. And I hope it doesn't. But there will be major problems. And in part because people are talking about democracy and political change, but you will still have these severe social and economic problems to deal with. You know, they're not going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's what people will have to face.
Yeah. And in terms of the U.S. response, it's kind of been all over the board here. First it was, you know, he needs to go, and he needs to go very soon. And now it's, well, let's play things out for a while and see what happens. Does it make any difference what we have to say?
Well, I think it does make a difference because I think people still look at the United States as not only an important power, but also I think, you know, people look at us also in an idealistic way.
Mm.
Despite our support, you know, for Israel, our support for these authoritarian governments, most people in these countries look at Americans differently than their government, and they like Americans, and so they are concerned about what we think and about what we say. They like the fact that we can express a whole variety of opinions. They like the fact that we are a multicultural nation, like themselves, just like Egypt, for that matter. With regard to the government, I thought that at first we were too involved. Excuse me. Let me have some water here.
Yeah, sure.
I guess it's my Milwaukee sinuses coming up here. But we were too involved with public diplomacy. And but then they began to quiet up a little bit, and I like that, you know, just working quietly, subtly. So right now, I think it is more of a wait and see. I mean, I once again, with this crowd that surged again over the last 36 hours, I think that caught people by surprise again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it caught me by surprise a little bit. I thought that maybe, you know, with the fact that Mubarak's not going to run, and that Gamal's not going to be involved with the party, Suleiman's not going to run, that this could have maybe tempered some of this. But no, and people just want a Mubarak out. They see him as a symbol of all that's gone wrong, at least politically with Egypt. And, you know, there have been, you know, certainly some important gains in Egypt over these decades, but you know, there's a lot of, there's a huge gap between the haves and the have-nots. If you go to North Cairo, I mean, out of the city a little bit, I mean, you cannot believe the building that is going on there.
Really?
Oh, it's incredible. And the building, and we're talking about, you know, substantial homes. And, you know, you just don't find that in Cairo. And of course, Cairo is an ancient city, and going back to the establishment of Fustat back in the 7th century. But that really struck me. We have a new campus. It's the American University in Cairo's campus is out there, and it's beautiful. But it's just people are moving out into that area, but people who obviously have some means.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot going on with your social, economic differences, differentiation, and then, of course, you have, though, what is interesting about the protesters is that you do have this wide band of social constituencies. I think it's great to see that. And so things are happening, and we'll just have to watch and see.
We'll welcome phone calls. We'll take them in just a moment here. We're talking about Egypt this hour of the program, and our guest has just returned from Egypt and also from Israel. He teaches about this area, Northern Africa, and has been writing in recent books about, you know, entertaining the question, what's going to happen when Mubarak does leave office? And, of course, we're addressing now, when is he going to leave office? Our guest left Cairo recently as the protests were really beginning to gather steam. He is Professor Philip Naylor, professor of history at Marquette University, and is author of a number of books, including North Africa, A History from Antiquity to the President, to the Present, Historical Dictionary of Algeria, France and Algeria, and many other books. Here's our phone number. A couple lines are open. I'm sure they're going to get crowded. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome your phone calls now. 800-486-8655. Starting with Chris. Hi, Chris.
Hello there. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question for the professor. I listen to the BBC every night, and my question pertains to the Islamic Brotherhood, what their political ideology is and why the West seems to fear them coming into power when we really haven't heard anything as far as negative about them or from the interviews that were hosted on the BBC.
Well, the Muslim Brothers, thanks for your question. The Muslim Brothers are a group which began in the 1920s, started by a man named Hassan al-Banna. And Hassan al-Banna was particularly concerned about colonial influences in Egypt. He was involved here with the development of, or with trying to strengthen, put it that way, the Egyptian identity. As time has gone by, you had the Brotherhood evolving, particularly during the 50s and 60s, when it was repressed by Gamal Abdel Nasser, into a much more of a radical group, You had a leader named Sayyid Qutb, who was executed in 1966, who saw Egyptian society and actually Muslim society in general as being in a state of jahiliyyah. Jahiliyyah means a state of ignorance, as if it was the period before Islam. Sorry, I'm giving you this history lesson, but it's important to put this in context.
Sure, no, it's good.
So after that, after Sayyid Qutb, the party evolved again and became a little bit more interested in becoming part of the system and actually participating in elections. And that's where they are basically right now. Now, within the Brotherhood itself, you have younger members who are quite liberal, who are willing to certainly have strong relations with the Copts. Copts are Christians who live in Egypt. There are approximately 6 to 8 million of them. There's a kind of a generational gap actually between the older members of the Muslim Brotherhood and the younger members. They are not a monolithic group. They are certainly not like Al Qaeda or anything or any group that is as radical as that. As a matter of fact, they don't get along with groups like that. Essentially, they are concerned about social and economic issues. They are concerned about Egyptian identity. They certainly question Egypt's policies with Israel. But I don't see them. I don't see them necessarily as a group that is going to come out and just say we should abrogate or get rid of the treaty with Israel. As I mentioned earlier, their power is projected if we have parliamentary elections, as we are bound to, I think eventually, maybe 20% to 40%. But even within the party itself, it's turning into more of an umbrella party rather than one that basically has a monolithic position. I hope that helps.
Yeah, that is helpful. Do we have it, and I can't remember the guy's name, somewhere in our heads that Bin Laden, one of Bin Laden's close associates,
Ayman al-Zawahiri, yeah.
Member of the Muslim Brotherhood.
He was attached to it. He's a fascinating individual, fascinating, unfortunately, in a kind of a grim way, too. He was very pro-Western, but then he turned against the West, saw the Brotherhood as a means, but the Brotherhood being much too conservative for him, got involved, if I recall, with Islamic Jihad before Islamic Jihad moderated also in Egypt and stopped its violence. But then, of course, but by that time he had aligned himself with Osama bin Laden.
Thanks, Chris, very much for the call. Let us go next to Virginia from Milwaukee. Hi, Virginia.
Good morning, Kathleen, and good morning to your guest, the professor. You'll have to excuse my voice. It's a little lower than usual, getting over a little sinus situation here.
Me too.
About 13 years ago, I was invited to come and stay with an Egyptian family. Over in Egypt. And though I had been a serious Bible scholar for over 10 years, reading about Egypt, never in my wildest dreams did I ever think that I would actually live there for 5 days, which I did. I went there and I got an education within that 5 days. We went to Cairo and went to the museum. I think we went to one museum there. It was my first impression was that, wow, the place was packed. This was one of the main museums. It was literally packed. You could hardly move. So I thought Egypt must be, if they're really bringing in the money, so people should be living pretty well. But in the village where I stayed with this gentleman's family, there were dirt floors. I asked if I could bring something special for his sisters. The one thing that they asked for was a vegetable peeler.
Hmm.
$1 vegetable peeler.
Hmm. So things haven't changed very much. That gap that you mentioned between those who have and those who have not has not been addressed.
Well, they haven't. They haven't. And particularly when you go into the agrarian areas, when you go into the rural areas, I mean, there's still severe poverty. You're still illiteracy, of course. You have that. You have that there. Going back to what you said concerning the museum, you know, tourism, of course, plays a very, very important role, and tourism is being hit extremely hard, extremely hard by this crisis. And that's, again, you know, very, 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 very hard on the Egyptian economy, an economy that needs the tourism, an economy that needs trade, an economy that is actually doing okay with regard to the Suez Canal transit right now. But about 2% of all global oil production flows through the canal. So not a lot, basically, but that's in pretty good shape. But they get $4 billion a year from transit fees through the canal. So a lot's going on. But your point about your point is well taken concerning just the people who need just the basic needs,
mm-hmm.
And just people who are just trying to survive. And that's still and that is still going on. 13 years after your visit.
Yeah. Thanks, Virginia, very much for your call. Minimum demands beyond the removal of Mubarak for the government to dissolve parliament, which is 95, I understand, percent controlled by the ruling National Democratic Party, an end to emergency law, and to start making constitutional changes. I wonder what those might be that would allow for democracy. Do you think those are going to happen? Do we add to that? Is that an accurate summation of
Yeah, I think they have to happen. I think something tangible, as I mentioned earlier, has to happen to satisfy the people in the street. Something, there has to be kind of an announcement. There has to be something that we are, you know, that we are going to recognize these parties officially. They are going to be part of the system now. There has to be some constitutional reforms, no question about that. I saw in the New York Times this morning Ahmed Zawail, who is a Nobel Prize winner, wanting to establish a committee of wise men to help, you know, formulate or frame a constitution. But something, again, tangible has to happen. If the situation stays the way it is right now, and kind of it's inert in a way here, I think that it's going to breed violence.
Ron is next from Blooming Grove. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I was listening between the lines, and I think I heard that there is a hidden plutocracy in Egypt that is even more powerful than the dictatorship, because somebody said that the stock market will open probably next Sunday, and if the stock prices drop significantly again, then the regime must go.
Yeah.
That implies to me that the moneyed interests who are invested in the stock market but not totally in control of it would control whether the current dictatorship continues or whether they get rid of it. Personally, I wish for our brothers and sisters in Egypt real democracy, more democracy than we have, that is less controlled by the big money interests. But I wonder if you could clarify this. Are the investors in the Egyptian stock market more powerful than the Pharaoh?
Okay, it's an excellent question. And like yourself, I see economics playing a very important role here. Yeah, there are, you know, you have, first, you do have people who are heavily invested in Egypt, who are also heavily invested in this government that is protecting their interests. However, if they see their interests dropping, if they see their financial situation, their portfolios, put it that way, dropping significantly, I think what's going to happen is that there's going to be a lot of pressure put on Mubarak. Mubarak being kind of a symbol of the current system, and they may want to bring in somebody else. Keep in mind, too, that there's another important patron here in the economy, and that is the army. The army has all sorts of connections, a tremendous system of patronage. I mean, you find it there in Egypt, and you find it in other countries, too, and I think of Algeria in particular. If they see their own enterprises also failing here, they will also, I think, put pressure on the government. So your point's well taken. And to call it a plutocracy, I mean, it's kind of hard to find Well, no, I take that back. I mean, you can actually pinpoint businessmen who are heavily invested politically in Egypt. I wouldn't call it a plutocracy, but there is a huge gap between the haves and the have-nots in Egypt and then across northern Africa, for that matter.
Thanks for the call. You got to wonder what it is about Mubarak that, despite all these protests of huge numbers of people, international pressure, however strong that may be, that he holds on to power. What's he thinking, that everything's going to turn around tomorrow?
Well, he might be thinking that he can still wait this out. People have to get back to work. Of course, you have a lot of people there in the protests who don't have a job to go to, for that matter. He obviously still has support within the military, and people are in part, when you look at Mubarak, and he's been there for 30 years, he has co-opted a lot of forces. And I think that plays a very important role here, that people kind of owe him, and they're willing to stay with him, at least for now. But as I mentioned before, I'm watching the economy. I know that Standard & Poor's dropped Egypt. I think it was last week. They dropped them down to maybe a double B standard or a double B evaluation, if I recall correctly. But we'll have to see. I mean, but it's the economy that's going to play an important role.
Mm-hmm. Dan is next from Three Lakes. Hi, Dan. And we have a couple lines open for the first time at 800-486-8655. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. I just, in the process of finishing this new book, Hero, Lawrence of Arabia, and I'm a little curious. Is France out of influence in North Africa now, including Egypt and so forth, and Algeria? And how much of the current problems in that neighborhood relate to the way France and England exercise colonial influence in the area? Well, and I'll listen off the air.
All right. Thanks, Ian.
Okay. The colonial influence, of course, was a major in Egypt with the Brits. Of course, we had the Suez Canal crisis in 1956, which was a major event. Certainly, France is heavily invested in North Africa, politically, economically, culturally, for that matter. When you look at Algeria, for example, Algeria is the largest French-speaking country outside of France. France is very much involved in these countries, and France has been taken to task, particularly with regard to Tunisia, for not being more critical of Ben Ali. France, saw Ben Ali as a source of stability. Within France, too, of course, you have a large North African community. And so there are a lot of connections between France and North Africa. And North Africa, particularly Algeria, has played a very important role with regard to France remaking itself after the colonial period. France has given a lot of aid to Morocco, a lot of aid to Algeria and to Tunisia, in part to refashion its own post-colonial image. But France is very much involved. It's an excellent question, and we'll have to see what type of role France will play in Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia. We haven't talked about Algeria at all, but there's going to be an important march in Algeria on the 12th of February, which has raised all sorts of red flags within the Algerian political system. And so we'll have to see. And if you recall, there were some self-immolations also in Algeria, and there was protests over rising food costs and unemployment there, too. So we'll have to see. Algeria is a major hydrocarbon producer, oil, and in particular, natural gas. A lot of its natural gas goes to the EU.
And what's supposed to happen on the 12th?
There's going to be a protest march.
A protest march,
but essentially a march for democracy.
Oh, my.
Well, we'll see. The Ministry of the Interior has denied the march. But again, you might have that social network operating, and you do have it operating. It's going to be interesting to see what happens there. And hopefully, by interesting, hopefully it will not be tragic or violent.
Right. Let us go next to Barbara in Madison. Hi.
Good morning, and thank you for this important program. As usual, Kathleen, you just excel with wonderful programs, and this is so timely for me. And I'm going to apologize a little bit for being self-serving, because my question is, my husband and I are elderly, and we are planning to leave for Israel on Tuesday morning. And both of us, frankly, were quite concerned about our safety and the spillover that might occur as a result of this uprising. And it's so sad for us. I loved Egypt and its history, and it's pathetic to have this happening. Could you comment on the safety issue, please?
Well, I felt certainly safe in Israel. And one of my friends there welcomed me, gave me a hug, and said, "Welcome to this oasis of stability," to quote him directly. And so I think that I don't think you have anything to worry about there. When it comes to Jerusalem and let's say East Jerusalem, I didn't see any type of instability there. I certainly felt differently in Jerusalem than Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv, very vital, kind of an exciting place. And Jerusalem, I felt to be a little bit oppressive, and that's only in part because, despite the great sites and the holy sites, you cannot get away from the Palestinian-Israeli situation there. And when it comes to safety and security, you can always contact the State Department, too. Just go on their website, and they can also fill you in. That's what I would, recommend. But from my own experience, I didn't, I felt, quite secure there.
Thanks very much for the call. Did you check with the State Department about Egypt before you went?
No, I didn't think so.
I didn't, Kathleen. I didn't think so. Let's welcome more phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our guest this hour is Professor Philip Naylor, professor of history at Marquette University. His special areas are North Africa, Europe, West Asia, and American history. And he just got back from Cairo, actually. He was there the evening of the 26th when the protests started to gather steam in Tahrir Square, and he also went to Israel. Part of the reason for going was to see how much interest there might be among students, and lo and behold, no surprise, there was a great deal of interest among students in attending Marquette University because of their extreme dissatisfaction with what's going on in colleges in Egypt. So he's just returned from the whole region, from being right there. So he has a very valuable perspective. Plus, he's a historian. So it's an even more valuable perspective. More phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good show planned for you tomorrow. Arlo Guthrie will be joining us in our downtown Milwaukee studios. He's going to be in town to sing and perform with the Milwaukee Symphony. I understand that Rhonda tells me his guitar is arriving on Friday, and he's coming in tomorrow. So do I bring my old guitar from home and ask him to play it? Huh? Would that be
too much?
Should I do that?
Yeah.
All right.
Absolutely.
I'll do that. I'll have to, and then he can tune it and everything. Because I don't know what he'll say, but he'll be with us in studio, and we have to ask him to perform. Our number two of the show, we always do in presidential history shows. We had Ron Reagan's show yesterday, and tomorrow and I want to ask Professor Naylor if he would agree with this, it's Andrew Johnson. You read this book and you wonder, how did this guy become president? And it was such an important time, and he kind of blew it, if you ask me. That's my take from the book. But we're going to talk about Andrew Johnson. Do you rank him among the worst presidents ever or not?
Wow. We have to switch over to American history.
Just for one second.
He had a very difficult situation because of the fact he had to deal with the end of the Civil War. He had to deal with that. But to be honest with you, it's been a while since I looked at that administration.
Yeah, me too.
I'm not sure grad school, So
well, you can listen tomorrow.
There you are.
It will be an interesting conversation. We usually talk about the great presidents, so tomorrow we look at one who's not considered great. Back to phone calls as we discuss Egypt this hour of the program, and Bill from Sun Prairie is our next caller. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
There have been two or three tribes that came down from the north into Egypt, and you know that they're a mixture of tribes, actually. And the Turks came down, and they reinforced the Muslim belief, and this has created a problem with the population explosion, as you understand. The Khazars, who they took up their Jewish belief, and they came down. And there was another tribe, the Finno-Ugrics. They left some place names, kind of interesting. Pyramid, Pyramita, wheel measure, and Egypt, Aikapitaya, timekeeper. I just bring that up because so few people realize that there is another language family, the Finno-Ugric language family.
All right. Thank you very much for the call, Bill. Let's go to John from Onalaska. Hi, John.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
We're very concerned about what our government's pronouncements are regarding the uprising in Cairo. But I wonder myself, I mean, America is sort of losing some of its influence worldwide, I think, and other countries are coming, you know, getting more influence. One would be China, and of course the EU, the strongest and biggest economic force in the world. How about Germany, France, Great Britain? What are they saying publicly?
Yeah, the EU has been supporting the United States position, basically, but I think your point is really well taken here. The EU, of course, is right there. They're on the Mediterranean. They are extremely, extremely sensitive to what goes on in North Africa, and in particular with regard to Egypt. But they've been following the lead, essentially, of the United States. Having said that, the Foreign Secretary of the UK is in Tunisia today, I believe, and so you know the UK, Britain is getting involved here. The French are watching all of this extremely carefully, also. And let's add another interesting observer here, and that would be the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, who is very concerned about stability in Egypt because of Egypt's role in the peace process in the region. So, yeah, the EU's involved. The UN is certainly, you know, watching this too, though its influence will not be as strong as other influences. China is invested. China's invested throughout Africa, certainly, and they're interested. The Japanese, I mean, this is an international, you know, problem. I saw an interesting piece from an Indian newspaper, you know, from India. They're watching all of this carefully too, and so it has captured the imagination of the world. And though the United States, of course, is still a major power, you are correct that we are, you know, living in a multipolar world, and that does not necessarily mean that the United States, you know, cannot, you know, exert its influence, but it can actually exert its influence in league with other powers, which could still be to our advantage.
Thank you very much. I was struck by Wael Guenaim. Is that how you pronounce his name? The Google activist who was released yesterday.
Yeah, Guenaim.
Guenaim. Who went to, which really says a lot about what's behind some of this, who went to a TV studio, the Dream Studio. He had been detained. He didn't know what had happened, really, and all that was unleashed after he was detained. Watching a slideshow of the young people who died at the hands of pro-government thugs while he was detained, one smiling young man after another, he broke down, racked with sobs. "I want to tell every mother and every father of the people who died, I am so sorry. I swear to God, it's not our mistake. It's the mistake of the people who are in charge of the country and don't want to leave their positions." And he got up and left the studio.
Right, right. That was a very moving movement, and it actually brought people into the street.
Mm.
It brought people into the street. And even the Journal Sentinel had that, and if you saw that story a couple of days ago about the young man who befriended a Wisconsin young woman, and he was shot down. It was heartbreaking. And so, you know, again, the youth are exasperated. They are alienated. They have contempt for the system, a system that basically keeps them out, you know.
Time for maybe one more phone call. Jackie in Drummond. Hi, Jackie.
Yep. Just kind of a far-reaching question. You know, you listen to all this, and the density of population in these developing and these countries that are so frustrated with their economic and employment situation, you know, until population stabilizes, could you just give me a insight as to what kind of economy would sustain, you know, this many people? And these are educated people and the poor people. It just seems like we don't deal with that aspect of all the social ills that are developing in poor countries.
Well, it's a great question, and it's a great observation. Modernization has its pluses and its negatives. For example, in Algeria, and it has a population problem too. The decision was made to industrialize, but industrialization was made in a way that was not not labor intensive, and so you know that did not help the job market at all. It's a question of just trying to find new technologies, and the Egyptians have been involved with this, but they just cannot handle the fact that you have hundreds of thousands of people entering the job market every year. And we're talking about many hundreds of thousands, and it's just a problem that not only these countries are involved with, but it's a problem for us too. It's a problem. It's a problem for countries that are advanced. So, anyways, we'll have to see. Again, the economies will play a very important role in this crisis, and we'll see what happens.
We thank you very much for being with us. I'm glad you're back safely. Thanks for all of your firsthand accounts, Professor Philip Naylor, professor of history at Marquette University, joining us in our downtown Milwaukee studios, having just returned from Cairo and Israel. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for all her production help.